The goal was to make Gaza uninhabitable. But I find it silly beyond words when people say Israel lost the war in Gaza, Hamas won the war in Gaza. There was no war in Gaza. There was a genocide in Gaza. It targeted the civilian population, and its goal was to once and for all to solve the Gaza question. And an honest reckoning, in my opinion, would have to say they achieved their goal.
That's Norman Finkelstein, and this is Alternative Radio. I'm David Barsamyan. This edition of AR features Norman Finkelstein on Israel's goal in Gaza. UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres said, "Conditions for Palestinians in Gaza are appalling and apocalyptic. What we are seeing may well amount to the gravest international crimes." Israeli Defense Minister Yoav Gallant said, "We are fighting human animals in Gaza, and we are acting accordingly." According to prominent Israeli scholars, such as Omar Bartov, Roz Siegel, Ilan Pape, Lee Mordecai, and Amos Goldberg, Israel's actions in Gaza amount to genocide. Amnesty International, Human Rights Watch, Jewish Voice for Peace, and other organizations have also reached the same conclusion. Apart from the United States, Canada, and a few European countries, Israel is largely isolated internationally. Arrest warrants for Prime Minister Netanyahu and Yoav Gallant have been issued by the International Criminal Court. Israel's goal in Gaza has been made explicitly clear by Netanyahu on down: eliminate the Palestinians. Our guest today is Norman Finkelstein, a distinguished independent scholar. He's the son of Holocaust survivors. He has long focused in his academic work on the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. He's the author of numerous books, and he's the subject of the documentary film American Radical. He spoke at the University of Wisconsin at Milwaukee in early February. And now, Norman Finkelstein.
So let's talk about the ceasefire in Gaza. What do you make of the structure of the ceasefire deal, the three phases? And why is it that a deal drafted in May of 2024 was accepted just a couple weeks ago?
Like most questions, but in particular pertaining to the Israel-Palestine conflict, it's important to be knowledgeable about the factual historical record, not just the present, but the past. I just have to go back a bit. Beginning in 2008-09, Israel conducted what it called operations in Gaza of a very significant magnitude. They called them not just operations, but they called them mowings of the lawn in Gaza. And the best known ones are Operation Cast Lead in 2008-09, began December 26, 2008, and it ended January 17, 2009. That's not a trivial fact. It ended 3 days before Barack Obama was inaugurated president, and Obama didn't want any distraction from his inauguration. So he gave the order to the Israeli government at the time, it was Ehud Olmert, to end Operation Cast Lead. After Cast Lead, there was an agreement of sorts, and the agreement had two aspects: the ceasefire and lifting or easing the brutal criminal medieval blockade of Gaza that began, or its most intensive phase began, in January 2006 when Hamas won the parliamentary elections and in effect became the government. The ceasefire happened. The lifting of the blockade did not. In 2012, there was Operation Pillar of Defense. It lasted a shorter period of time. It lasted only a week. And that too ended with a ceasefire, and it was supposed to end with an easing or lifting of the blockade. When the agreement came before the Israeli government, at that time, Ehud Barak was the defense minister. And he said, once the ceasefire is signed, everything else in the agreement, apart from the ceasefire, will be forgotten. That means the part about lifting the blockade or easing the blockade of Gaza. Same thing happened during Operation Protective Edge, July, August, 2014. It was 51 days. Again, there was the ceasefire and then the promise to ease or lift the blockade of Gaza. The first happened, the second didn't. I should also add, on May 31st, 2010, there was a humanitarian flotilla en route to Gaza carrying humanitarian materials. It came under Israeli attack, the flotilla. The Israeli commandos killed 9 passengers aboard the flagship vessel, the Mavi Marmara. A 10th died later. After the Mavi Marmara incident, it evoked international furor. After it, there was the promise to ease the blockade of Gaza. Never happened. So now we come to the present. There's this three-stage, as it's called, agreement. As some of you will know, stages 2 and 3, they're not even part of the public record. Just stage 1 has been published. Judging from the record, we can say the following things. 1, why was it signed now? There the answer is perfectly obvious in my opinion, though many people disagree. Namely, a month before President Trump was inaugurated, he said all hell would break out if the hostages weren't released. Well, he had 2 problems. It was a bit late in the day to threaten all hell because all hell had broken out under President Biden. There was not much left hell to inflict on Gaza. 2, the Israeli genocide in Gaza gradually became unpopular even in the United States. And so President Trump didn't want to begin his term of office like a monster, because he recognized he's not a genius politician, but it doesn't require one to understand he doesn't want the Gaza albatross on his watch. So he's not going to unleash even more firepower on the defenseless refugee child population. On the other hand, he doesn't want to come across like a blowhard. He threatened all hell would break loose if the hostages weren't released. And so he basically conveyed to Netanyahu, you have to have a hostage exchange for the Palestinians being held hostage. You have to have a hostage exchange. But the rest, like Ehud Barak said after Operation Pillar of Defense, it'll all be forgotten. In my opinion, probably the whole hostage aspect, as in hostage for hostage, that will be played out. The rest clearly will never be played out. Israel did not spend 16 months to reduce Gaza to rubble to suddenly decide, along with John Lennon in my generation, let's give peace a chance and rebuild Gaza. That's not plausible. That's not credible. That's not believable. So that first phase, the ceasefire and hostage for hostage, will be carried out. The rest, one has to be honest about these things. We're all adults in this room. And part of respecting people is not to paint rosy pictures. We have to have a firm handle on reality as we figure out how to go forward. Right now, I think everybody in this room knows the picture is very grim. It's not grim because of what President Trump pronounced a couple of days ago, that he's going to build a golf course and a casino in Gaza. That's not the grim part. The grim part is a physical reality. The physical reality is Gaza is no more. The last UN statistics I looked at from a couple of weeks ago said that, number one, 92% of the homes in Gaza have either been destroyed or seriously undermined. What's the word? Seriously
damaged.
Damaged. 92%. There's 50 million tons of rubble in Gaza. I want to give you a sense of what 50 million tons means. I mentioned earlier Operation Cast Lead. For those old enough to remember 2008-09, when Operation Cast Lead happened, it was a horror on a scale not seen before. And I wrote a little book on the topic, and I took the title from an Israeli journalist named Gideon Levy. And the title was, "This Time We Went Too Far." For those who remember those days, there was huge outrage at Operation Cast Lead. Well, at the end of Operation Cast Lead, the estimates were there were 600,000 tons of rubble. So put that number in your head, 600,000 tons of rubble. Operation Protective Edge in 2014, July, August 2014, Operation Protective Edge, it was such a monstrosity that the head of the International Committee of the Red Cross, his name was Peter Maurer, and his job description was basically just to tour war zones. He came to Gaza after 2014, and he said, and I'm quoting him now, "In all my professional life, I've never seen the level of destruction that I saw in Gaza." At the end of Operation Protective Edge, the estimate was 2.5 million tons of rubble. By 2023, Gaza hadn't even rebuilt from Operation Protective Edge. So we had 600,000 tons of rubble. And now we come to Gaza. You know what the figure for the rubble is? 50 million tons. The best estimates are, if Israel were to allow in 100 trucks a day, it would take 15 years just to clear out the rubble. The rubble is mixed in with unexploded ordnance and toxic substances. I won't start going through the question of the infrastructure that was destroyed, the waste, sanitation, electricity, all of it was systematically destroyed. The biggest misnomer, the biggest misapprehension about Gaza in the past 16 months, the biggest falsehood about Gaza is that it was a war with Hamas. It wasn't a war, and it wasn't with Hamas. Hamas was just a sideshow. The goal was, and the Israelis made it absolutely clear, one of the interesting aspects of this past 16 months is there is a large number of compilations of just statements by Israeli, from the senior officials down to the lowest level, across the political spectrum, and including every aspect, division of civil life in Israel. And what comes across with a kind of mind-numbing detail is the goal was to destroy Gaza. It had nothing to do with Hamas. Hamas was a sideshow. Israel was determined, as I said earlier, they used to call their operations mowings of the lawn. And this time around, they decided, we're not mowing the lawn anymore. We're going to extirpate, that's the fancy word for pull out by the roots. We're going to extirpate every blade of grass in Gaza. And they were going to do it basically three ways, but each of the modus operandi, they overlapped. One, we're going to try a mass ethnic cleansing. And at the time, Tony Blinken, the Secretary of State, went to Egypt and tried to convince the head of state to accept the mass expulsion into the Sinai. No. And so the mass ethnic cleansing was put on hold. It's not true that it was totally unsuccessful. Depending on who you read, between 100 and 200,000 people in Gaza have left in the past 15 months. But on the whole, it was unsuccessful. The second method was just an outright genocide, just an outright mass killing. And that too, by any comparative reckoning, was remarkably successful. If you look at standard indices, number of civilians to combatants killed, number of children to total number killed, number of women and children versus adult males killed. If you look at all the standard indices, number of journalists killed, number of medics killed, number of UN workers killed, by every measure, Gaza is in a class so completely its own. I'll give you one example. In the first 3 weeks of October, October 7th to October 31st, the estimate is 1,900 children were killed. So fix that number in your mind, 1,900. Most everybody will agree that Assad's regime in Syria was a very brutal regime. I think it's silly, pointless, and embarrassing to argue otherwise. And the most brutal year of his regime was said to be 2016. You know how many children were killed in the worst month of 2016 in Syria? 279. In the worst month, Gaza, in 3 weeks, 1,900. Actually, in the worst year in Syria, the year 2016, the total number of children killed under that brutal dictatorship of Bashar Assad, roughly the same number, 1900 and something, were killed in 1 year as in Gaza in 3 weeks. So the genocide phase, by any comparative reckoning, was quite successful in Gaza. But the overarching goal was very simple. We're simply going to make Gaza uninhabitable, and then the people will have to leave. Now, you might say I'm Monday morning quarterbacking in light of what the statements have been made in the past week or so. I said it from day one. It was, if you look, I did 1,000 interviews, and you will see in every one I said the goal was to make Gaza uninhabitable, so as to say the population has to leave. There's nothing to go back to. And that's exactly what they achieved their goal. I don't want to engage in an open quarrel now, because we need solidarity. But I find it silly beyond words when people say Israel lost the war in Gaza, Hamas won the war in Gaza. There was no war in Gaza. There was a genocide in Gaza. It targeted the civilian population, and its goal was to once and for all to solve the Gaza question. And an honest reckoning, in my opinion, would have to say they achieved their goal. Now, how it's going to be resolved from here on in, I can't say. There's an element of unrealism to imagine that the people of Gaza are somehow made of stone, that they would insist on staying, and they won't make the decision, you know what, there's nothing to go back to. And there won't be anything to go back to for maybe 15 years. Bear in mind, it would take 15 years to clear away the rubble. We're not even talking about reconstruction. So it's a very grim picture.
Just to let everyone know, some parts of the ceasefire agreement that have been publicized have said that a timeline of 3 to 5 years of rebuilding Gaza is what they're going to put in place. Even Trump's Middle East special envoy called this preposterous. And just as a frame of reference, that new chemistry building on campus took 6 years to design and build. And they want to allow 3 to 5 years worth of reconstruction in Gaza to rebuild the entirety of the Gaza Strip. How do you think they came up with that number? I mean, this is absurd. Is it something they threw in there?
When you follow the conflict closely, you discover that all the numbers are completely made up. Every number is just pulled from thin air. It's so laughable. I'll just give you a few examples to illustrate the point. The New York Times reports things like there are 450 miles of tunnels in Gaza. 450 miles, and they say, you know, our sources, our secret sources. There's this Israeli intelligence agent who masquerades as a reporter for the Times named Ronan Bergman, and he says, according to my sources, yeah, what's his sources? The sources is the Mossad. They want to feed disinformation to the United States. They throw numbers at him. 450 miles of tunnels. So I was curious about that number. Where did they come up with it? How many people have been to New York City in this room? Raise your hand. Oh, fine. How many people have rode the subway system? Good. So, you know, it's a pretty complex, rarefied subway system. the 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, A line, B line, C line, D line, all the way to Z, some letters missed. It's a very complex system. So I did a little research the way young people do now. I go on the web and I looked up how many miles are in the New York City subway system. 430. So you're telling me there are more tunnels in Gaza than there are in my New York City subway system. No, that's not really believable. That's not really believable. I checked with some civil engineers in Gaza and they said it's complete nonsense. Even Sinwar, who was given to the late Mr. Sinwar, who was given to boasting, that's part of the psychological game, I get it. He said 300 miles of tunnels, but Israel says 430. Why are they 450? Why do they say 450? Because then it justifies destroying all of Gaza. You can always say we're targeting tunnels. So it pulls the number out of thin air. Then the figure for the number of Hamas combatants killed. How could you possibly know that number? First of all, the Israeli Gaza Ministry of Health says we don't know the number. And they deal with the dead bodies. It's not as if members of Hamas walk around with an ID card that says terrorist. No. How would they know? Everything is obliterated. Before the Israeli, the IDF as it's called, before it takes one step, it obliterates everything in front of it. How would they know how many Hamas militants are buried there? If you follow the numbers as I do, you know what the number always is? It's very simple. Whatever is the total figure for the number of Gazans who are estimated to have been killed, Israel will say the number of combatants killed is in a proportion of either 1 or 1.5 to 2. So let's say if the official number of Gazans killed is 40,000, Israel will say 18,000 were Hamas terrorists. Why did they do that? Because they want to say this is the cleanest war ever fought. That the ratio is usually 1 to 6, one combatant for 6 civilians or 1 combatant for 9 civilians. So they'll say in Gaza, it's 1 or 1.5 to 2. So they simply calculate the number of combatants to show that this is the cleanest war ever fought in the history of humankind. All the numbers are just completely made up when you look at them closely or if you have any sense of what's going on there. Ironically, and it is ironically, I think, the Israelis and their propagandists said the Gaza Ministry of Health was exaggerating the number of people killed. And along comes an article in Lancet, the most respected medical journal in the world. It's a British medical journal. And they said, yes, it's true. The Gaza Ministry of Health was exaggerating downward that the number of people in Gaza killed was probably about 40% more than the Gaza Ministry of Health was saying. So yes, it was exaggerated, as the Israelis say, but it was exaggerated downward, not upward.
You're listening to Norman Finkelstein on Israel's Goal in Gaza. This is Independent Alternative Radio. For copies of this program, call us 1-800-444-1977. That's 1-800-444-1977. Or online, our website, alternativeradio.org.
Arab governments have largely remained passive spectators as Gaza has been reduced to rubble, despite their immense wealth and influence. While some have made symbolic gestures or pledged aid, many continue to normalize ties with Israel or avoid direct confrontation. What role should the Arab governments play in, let's say, rebuilding Gaza or relieving the population of Gaza from this destruction and sorrow?
I'm not going to talk to the should, because there the answer is obvious. I want to talk about what the historical record shows. There was a period when the Palestine cause had immense, not material power, obviously, didn't have an army or economic wealth, but it had something else, and it's an interesting fact. It had quite significant symbolic power, which is to say, Arab governments genuinely feared the Palestinian cause. So if you take one example, which I'm familiar with because I've studied the historical record, Jimmy Carter recently passed. He was an extremely smart guy. And in his own way, he was an honorable guy. He was an awful president. He was the one that negotiated the Israel-Egypt agreement beginning in 1977 and climaxing in 1979. And it was very impressive to read the historical record. He just knew exactly what to do. He was very systematic, very methodical, and he had a terrifying grasp of detail. I mean, it would take your breath away to read, because we have the original documents and how he makes these marginal comments. You know, when his advisors present to him some agreement to read or pertaining to Israel-Palestine, and you read his marginal comments and the level of micro detail that he had mastered was totally breathtaking. In any event, when he comes into office, he's determined he's going to solve the whole Israel-Palestine conflict. He then realizes that the Israelis are too dug in their heels. You can't do it. The only thing the Israelis were willing to do was to sign an agreement with Egypt. And the reason was very simple. It'll be a big surprise among young people, but Egypt was the powerhouse of the Arab world up until this Camp David agreement that was negotiated by President Carter or through President Carter. And the foreign minister at the time, who was also prominent in the military establishment, was a fellow named Moshe Dayan. And Dayan famously said, if you remove one wheel from a car, the car is stuck. It can't move. And so he said, if we remove the Egyptian wheel from the Arab front, they can't make war anymore, because Egypt was the powerhouse. So Israel didn't want another war like 1973, which was a pretty big catastrophe for them in many ways. The estimates are between 2,000 and 3,000 Israeli combatants were killed. And for a while, it looked like Israel was going to disappear. Turned out to be inflated, that fear, but it was actually believed. So they wanted to make the Arab world impotent, and the way they thought to do it was to remove the Egyptian wheel from the car. So Israel was willing to sign an agreement with Egypt, but no more. Whereas the Arab world wanted to just solve the problem. That is, a two-state settlement according to international law. The Palestinians have the right to self-determination and statehood in the West Bank, including East Jerusalem and Gaza, and so forth. So why do I bring all this up? I bring it up because Jimmy Carter, being very systematic and methodical, he tours the whole Arab world. He goes to the Saudis, of course, and he says, if there's an agreement between Egypt and Israel, will you support it? The Saudis say, nope, we can't do anything unless you give the Palestinians a state. Now remember, Palestine, they have no material power. They have no military power, but they have this tremendous symbolic power in the Arab world. The Arab head of state says, we cannot agree to a deal that doesn't give the Palestinians a state. And Sadat, as you can imagine, he's panicking because if he can't get any support from the Arab world for this agreement, then it's going to make him look like a traitor. And you know what happens to traitors? They get shot. And so in many ways, Jimmy Carter was responsible for Sadat's assassination because he insisted on the deal in the absence of any Arab support. Now, I want to be clear, Sadat wanted the deal too, for sure, because the country was going through food riots, it was very unstable, and he just wanted the American money. He wanted to join the American alliance. He basically, if you read the record, he said to Carter, you do whatever you want and I'll agree with you. Whatever you want, you just do it and I'll sign. And so he was, Jimmy Carter was Egypt's negotiator. So that's no longer true. Palestine doesn't have symbolic value the way it once did in the Arab world. And the question is why? I think the obvious answer is because since that era, there have been so many catastrophes in the Arab world. There's been Iraq, there's been Libya, there's been Syria, and on, that the horror of the situation among the Palestinians began to pale in the face of now the inward-looking countries of the Arab world faced with all of their own domestic calamities and catastrophes. I'm not making an apology. I'm simply stating the facts. There were about 2 million Syrian refugees in Turkey, 1.5 million Syrian refugees in Lebanon. That's the total population of Gaza, these numbers. And these are the catastrophes that have befallen the Arab world. Having said that, the fact remains, apart from the Houthis in Yemen and the Hezbollah in Lebanon, the Arab world abandoned the people of Gaza. If you look at the various operations I mentioned, there was very little support in the West Bank for the people of Gaza, very little. During the Great March of Return in March 2018, there was no support, none in the West Bank for the nonviolent civil resistance in Gaza. The fact of the matter is, if you put aside the Houthis in Yemen and the Hezbollah in Lebanon, the biggest support for Gaza, and it's a tremendously moving in its own way, you know where it came from? South Africa. South Africa was so tenacious, persistent, Most of you know some of the record, but you don't know all of the record. They submitted on December 29th, 2023, what they called an application to the ICJ, International Court of Justice, charging that Israel was in violation of the 1948 Genocide Convention. Their application was 84 pages. It was single-spaced. It had over 500 footnotes. And for each footnote, there were like three references. It was a huge amount of work. Israel ignored what the ICJ ruled in January. They go before the court again in February. They submit a new compilation of documentation. The court says Israel has to do what it was ordered to do in January. It repeats that. Israel ignores. South Africa goes before them again in March. Another thick compilation of facts, statistics, references, and so forth. And then guess what? It goes before them again in May. It keeps pushing and pushing and pushing. And then if you go to, it's called Letter to the Secretary, Security Council, Letter to the Security Council, May 29th, 2024. They give up on the ICJ because Israel is ignoring it. And they now go to the Security Council. And they say, Israel is ignoring what the ICJ said. You have to act. And they submit a compilation. It's 121 pages. And it is so meticulously documented. I mean, it's just a breathtaking amount of work and investment. And now the case itself is before the court. And hold your breath. They submitted a 750-page, what's called memorial, with 4,000 pages of supplementary documentation. Now you ask yourself, what did the rest of the Arab world do? I think the silence answers the question, as in nothing. I don't blame the people. Yeah, I'm sure their hearts go out. Why did the Houthis, why are they so adamant? You know why? Because what was done to Gaza was done to them. The Saudi blockade. The Saudi blockade, which I think killed in 2 years, I don't remember the exact number, but something like 80,000 people died from starvation because of those Saudi monsters. So they know what was done, what's being done to Gaza was done to them. And the Hezbollah, you know, people want to say it's manipulated by Iran. And yeah, there was, you know, you can't deny the fact that Iran is a factor. But my own estimate, I'm not going to argue with people because I know people from Syria have very sincere, legitimate grievances against the Hezbollah. And I'm not going to quarrel with that. But I think on the whole, Sayyid Nasrallah was an extremely intelligent, honorable, and dignified figure. And I think his death left a huge void in the Arab world. He was a new voice. He was a new voice in the Arab world. He cared. Some of you know Edward Said. And when Hassan Nasrallah was a young man, Edward Said met him. And he wrote just briefly about him because he wasn't well known at the time when Professor Said wrote about him. And he said, there's two things about Nasrallah, which differ from any other Arab leader he said I've ever met. Number one, he was always on time. No, it's a sign. It's a sign of seriousness. You know, the other Arab leaders, they come in 5 hours late, like they're so important and everybody else's time is unimportant. So they'll come in 5 hours late, 7 hours late. and he was always on time. And number two, all the other Arab leaders he met, meaning Professor Said, they were always surrounded by armed militia with their, you know, with their machine guns. He said, when you met Hassan Nasrallah, no, none of that, none of those theatrics. It was serious. He read. I remember Professor Chomsky met him. They met for a serious amount of time. And you asked Professor Chomsky, so what was he like? And Professor Chomsky will say, you don't really know, because all he did was ask questions. He just wanted to suck in information. He wasn't there to show off, to show how much, you know, how important he is. He wanted to learn.
I know a lot of people were shocked with the recent statement by President Trump that he's going to turn Gaza into basically a Riviera and take over. I actually found it to be amusing, and I thought that there's some truth to this, in the sense that it was put out because Trump is not a politician, and he says what's basically happening. And I think what was made very clear is that this is a case of ethnic cleansing. And the fact that Netanyahu stood there smirking next to him, I think for the entire world now to say, you know, including the students that have been harassed by the university for asking for divestment, et cetera, then now it's for the entire world to see that this is a case of ethnic cleansing, and it's intentional. I think also it's going to make it a little bit more difficult for Arab governments, as tyrannical and non-representative as they are, to stand with someone like Trump and to say, yeah, you know, we want to work with you, when he clearly said, I'm going to ethnically cleanse Gaza.
Well, I happen to agree with all of those statements. I think you would have to be more blind than King Lear not to see what was going on the last 15 months. It was an ethnic cleansing which didn't succeed at the beginning because Egypt said no go into the Sinai. And then it became an ethnic cleansing by default, namely, there's nothing left. And so the people have to go. And I have to acknowledge, it is a tough question now. What do you do? There is nothing there. And I don't have, you know, people want to conjure these heroic images of Palestinians. And yes, they've been extremely tenacious and have been heroic. But at the end of the day, they're human beings. They're not supermen and they're not superwomen. So if you read the stories, yes, they did march en masse to the north after the ceasefire began. But if you read the footnotes, when they went to the north and they discovered nothing was there, and there was no water, a lot of them turned around and went back to the south, to their tents. It doesn't make them less heroic. If you read the statements of the Israelis, the ones that are not reported here, but are in abundance when you read them, collected, that was the whole goal, to make Gaza unlivable, so that the people of Gaza would have two choices: stay and starve or leave. That was the goal. Now, you could deduce the goal on the basis of what they were saying, or you could deduce it or infer it from their actions. If you destroy 92% of the housing, what choice do the people of Gaza have? I don't think there's...
If you want to take them from Gaza, as I said, let them go to where they belong. You know all the people of Gaza from where? They are from Yafa, from Haifa, from Lid, from Ramla. The Israeli kicked them out. They should go back to their homeland. That's where they should go.
Is there any hope to de-radicalize the youth within Israel, or is their Zionist beliefs too deep-rooted? And if so, how should that process be made?
What you call the youth are the ones who are in the front line carrying out the genocide inside Gaza. They're the most over the top. So anyone looking for hope there, I think it's an utter waste of time. In some situations, there's no rational grounds for hope for a population. If you take the United States during the Civil Rights Movement, the whites in the South were very dug in. You can count on the fingers of one hand the number of whites in any town who supported an end to the Jim Crow segregation system. The only way to break it was when the federal government, for various reasons, decided it was time to end that system. And they brought to bear, for various reasons, the full weight of our national government, including its armed force, to break the will of the South, to look for, quote unquote, progressive whites in the American South, was a complete waste of time. It didn't exist. And I don't believe there is any, quote unquote, progressive, let's just call it, there's no significant anti-genocide sentiment inside Israel. As Lee Mordechai pointed out in his compilation, Israel's most revered newspaper for its liberal sentiments is Haaretz. And there was very little dissent, he said, in Haaretz, which liberals here love to quote. It was very little dissent. He said in his compilation, Haaretz went along with the genocide. That's the liberal, ultra-liberal sectors of Israeli society. It's a uniform response across the board there. And as I said, it's pretty hard to fathom when you read it. There was that great African-American athlete, singer, he was everything, Paul Robeson. And I was very angry when I came into the Milwaukee airport and they had a poster of great African-Americans. They didn't have Paul Robeson and they didn't have W.E.B. Du Bois on it. And I said, I'm not coming back to this airport. In any case, he used to sing the song, The House I Live In. What is America to me? And then he has the famous line, the right to speak my mind out. That's America to me. The right to speak my mind out. If it makes you uncomfortable, walk away. If it makes you feel unwanted, go among a crowd where you feel wanted. And if it makes you feel unsafe, fine, you can call the police, but the police can't arrest you for speaking your mind out. We should seize back those rights, those values, and hopefully turn the tide.
You were just listening to Norman Finkelstein on Israel's goal in Gaza. Norman Finkelstein, son of Holocaust survivors, is a distinguished independent scholar who has long focused on the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. This program is produced by Alternative Radio. We're an independent nonprofit in our 39th year. We're supported solely by individuals just like you. We feature such voices as Rami Khoury, Ilan Pape, Ralph Nader, Peter Beinert, Francesca Albanese, and Arundhati Roy. To access our complete audio and book catalog, just go to our website, alternativeradio.org. Again, our website where we are podcasting, alternativeradio.org. For copies of today's program, Norman Finkelstein on Israel's Goal in Gaza, and for the Rashid Khalidi classic book, The 100 Years' War on Palestine, call us 1-800-444-1977. That's 1-800-444-1977. Or go online, our website, alternativeradio.org. That's alternativeradio.org. Printed transcripts, PDFs, and MP3s of this program are free of charge. Just call us, 1-800-444-1977. Joe Ritchie is our general manager and editor. I'm David Barsamyan. Thank you for listening. We go out with Paul Robeson singing The House I Live In.
What is America to me? A name, a map of the flag I see. A certain word and democracy. What is America to me? The house I live in, the friends that I have found, the folks beyond the railroad, and the people all around, the worker and the farmer, the sailor on the sea, the men who built this country, that's America to me.